Okay, so I'm sitting there. You know, I have my marketing people that are doing their thing. I have salespeople that are doing their thing. We're still not meeting our numbers. What is the first thing I need to do?
Lock them in a room and make them talk to each other. And I think that's, you know, order some pizzas and let them sit and have some pizzas and beer and talk and figure out how to get along with each other and how to help each other out. Because they're doing what they've been told to do. The marketing people don't hate sales. They have different goals and objectives. So somebody has told them, this is what you need to do this year. This is, if you're going to be of value to the company, we need a better website, or we need to have all new marketing collateral done because this is, you know, out of date, or we need to have a German version of our marketing literature, and this is your priority. Well, that's fine. Those things need to be done, but they also need to spend time with sales, and sales needs to spend time with marketing and appreciate that they won't drop what they're doing just to do something that sales needs.
Welcome to the B2B Digital Marketer Podcast, a podcast helping you to end your struggle with digital marketing, helping you to pave a new and better path to target and capture your ideal customer. Each week, we teach you how insiders and experts debunk the dreary and become engines of innovation. Now, here's your host, Jim Rembach.
Okay, B2B DM gang, I think you need to get ready. You need to be taking a lot of notes. And we talk about, you know, things that are impactful, and this conversation is going to be one, because here's the reality of what we know today. And a report came out here recently that said 67% of B2B sellers are not meeting quota. 67%. It's not half anymore. It was half. Now, I mean, we're hearing that more and more are actually getting to the point where they're not meeting quota. Now, we can sit there and argue about all the different root causes and associated with that. And yes, they're plentiful. And one of them may be even delusional, you know, organization setting, you know, some of these projections and forecasts. But that's not the issue. The issue is, what can we do as sellers to be able to convert, right? How do we actually become not one of the 67%, right? But we're actually on the better side of that. And to help us with that discussion and exploration is Steve Weinberg. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jim. It's good to be here.
Oh, thank you. Now, Steve is the author of Above Quota Performance, Tips and Techniques to Becoming a Master Sales Pro. Now, here's the thing too, is when I started looking at the book, it actually goes beyond, you know, just what oftentimes you may see as the selling activity and goes into some of the marketing aspects of sales as well. That's right. Marketing needs to feed your sales. How it does that and approaches that you take and the strategies you take can differ quite significantly. But ultimately, it's how do we get to the point to where all of what we're doing, all of what we're thinking, all of what we're deploying, all of our systems, all our practices, all our behaviors are leading to above quota performance. So, Steve, if you could, mention that statistic that I saw that just came out as far as 67% of B2B sellers not making quota. Why would you say that they're not making it?
As you alluded, there are a lot of different reasons, including unrealistic goals. But let's put that aside. But historically, it hasn't really changed much over the years. It's been 50% for like 20, 25 years. And I think the last 2 or 3 years since the pandemic, it's become much harder, much more difficult to reach quota because a lot of us salespeople were used to going into someone's office or their meeting room and meeting with the key executives and sitting down with them and talking to them and maybe socializing with them and then getting on to discussing their problems and then trying to figure out how to solve their problems. Well, now what's going on is companies, they do all the research before they even contact you, and they give you anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes on a Zoom call. You're not familiar with them. You don't know the people. You don't know what their likes, dislikes are. You may have gotten some information about their strategy and needs, but it's a lot more limited than it used to be. So salespeople are really, I think today, are almost fighting with one arm tied behind their back. It's much more difficult today than it used to be. And I started in sales at the end of the 70s. I'm originally an accountant by training. So I got into that in the 70s and at the time when software products were starting to take off. And I've seen the evolution of that. But today, again, in the digital marketplace, the customer, the buyer, is much better informed. They usually know what they want before you come in. They'll make a decision. Within minutes, they'll look at you and decide, okay, are we going to consider this company? And that's it. It'll be just a couple of minutes, where in the past, when you met with them in a room, you had a little bit more time to really create rapport with them and for them to decide whether or not they would consider you.
Okay, so now you kind of alluded to this, and now I want to give an opportunity for you to focus in on that specifically, is talk about your experience going all the way back, you know, to the 70s. Tell us a little bit about how, you know, you're writing this book, and all these insights are coming from this book. And we're also going to share 8 ideas that have not been seen anywhere else about how to, you know, have above quota performance. So tell us a little bit about your background, Steve.
Well, my background, as I mentioned, is I have an accounting and economics and finance background, an MBA, and I started working in accounting. And then I was hired by a company to implement software packages for them, which I really didn't know anything about. So at the conclusion of implementing one, they moved me to the next one, and then the next one. And then eventually one of the owners of the software company offered me a sales position in Chicago. At the time I was in Phoenix, and I moved back to Chicago, which is where I'm from. And I started selling, and I had no training, pretty much no leads, but I knew the product really well. And at that time I knew the product and I knew the competitors. So I was able to differentiate the product and explain to the people that I was meeting with that were similar to my background, how it could help them out. So it was really, I could relate with them really well. And I really didn't have to do anything on the sales side, as far as, you know, no special closes or sale tricks or anything like that. It was really a matter of me leveraging my knowledge to help them solve their problem. Well, the market changed and more competitors came in, and competitors came out with better products than what we had. And my skills had to change. So during that time, I was extremely successful. I was always the top salesperson on the company. And then I eventually was promoted to VP of sales at the company I was with, and then became VP of sales at several companies and a president of one software company. And then at the end of my career, I retired just a couple of years ago from active selling. I actually moved back into an individual sales role. I decided that this is what I wanted to do. And I went back and did that. And that was really, it was wonderful for me. It gave me an opportunity to use the skills that I had accumulated over the years and test some of the ideas that I've been promoting to everybody else.
So if I look at you're talking about the skills and applying all that you've learned, you know, you've written this book, and it's in 4, you know, pretty significant and meaningful sections. And so, you know, we talk about, you know, the sales quota piece, we talk about, you know, the secret to selling and getting in, you talk about mastering the enterprise selling process, the value propositions associated with the helping selling. And then you also talk about sales presentations, best practices, and things like that. But I think you mentioned something that's critically important, is how things have differed and changed. Also, when you start thinking about the importance of the relationship piece, you know, what are some of these things that we're unfortunately forgetting? And for a multitude of different reasons, what are some of these things that we're forgetting that are essentially our core pillars to being successful in regards to being above quota?
Well, it used to be that maybe one or two products were better than all the others, and the buyers could see that and they bought it. And whether they liked you or they didn't like you, they would, if they saw the product was better, they usually bought it. Today, everybody's got good products, or most people have good products. Competition is fierce, and the companies are, the buyers are much better informed. In prior times, when we met with them, we would explain to them a lot of what they needed to know. Today, they know it. So when you meet with them, they have their list ready of all the things that they already like or dislike about what you have. But going on to the relationship side, today, I think that most buyers will only buy from people that they trust and people that they believe will solve their problems. And it's not necessarily whether they like them. It used to be salespeople would say that buyers will buy from people they like. Now they don't need to like them. They need to trust them. And the trust is really, do they believe that you are there to solve their problems and to help them? Or do they believe you're just trying to close another sale and try to reach quota? If it's the latter, you're not going to make the sale in 90% of the time. If it's the former, you have a shot. So you need to convince them that you're there to help them. And, you know, and in my practice, I actually, on a few occasions, went into companies and I told them not to buy from me because I didn't think it was a good fit. And later on, it turned out that I was able to sell them other things later because they trusted me.
Well, as you're talking, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking about what you had mentioned before in regards to buyer knowledge. And I think sometimes we actually move on some false pretenses. And what I mean by that is if we start thinking about solutions, you know, to complex problems, that isn't met with a simple solution. So complex problems require complex solutions.
Right.
And so when you start talking about the mass amount of information that currently exists out there, if people within their own level of knowledge and understanding who are buyers are collecting information and making decisions, it's that they don't have a lot of depth to their understanding. So the things that they may have may not be totally and fully accurate. That's one of our issues. The other thing is, if we start looking at what we've done over the past couple of years, is we've created in organizations, or organizations have created a whole lot of content that actually is causing more confusion. So there's a study that came out that said, because of the mass amount of information that exists out there, it is actually making it 18% more difficult for buyers to make a decision. Because again, think about this: complex problems, complex solutions. I'm sticking right. my neck or my butt out. Well, you know what? I need to make sure that I make a right decision, so I'll just research yet a little bit more.
Right, they do, and they'll research for months. And as salespeople, we're frustrated because we can't understand why it's taking so long.
And it's because the trust piece is missing.
Because the trust is missing, and the salesperson really needs to understand what the buyer is trying to achieve. And one of the eight items that's in my book that I haven't seen anywhere else is that all sales books will help salespeople walk through what they need to do to make a sale. Step one is this, step two is this, step three is so forth. And they'll all do that in various ways. One of the chapters that I added is, let's look at the other side of the equation. Let's look at what the buyer is doing. While you're trying to sell them, what are they doing? And how are they reacting? And understand what activities are going on their end. And so I've included that in there. And I interviewed a number of buyers and purchasing people, procurement people, in order to add to the knowledge I already had. But again, and a lot of that is really just is not available to the sellers today that it used to be in the past. We used to have a whole lot more visibility into what was going on in an organization, and now there's less visibility.
Okay,
they really.
So how do we change that, and do we need that, or do we just try to move forward and omit or divert around that?
Well, the way right now, we need to do a lot more work in terms of one-on-one questioning of the individuals on the sales side, on the buyer's side, I mean, during the sales process. So let's say the sales team consists of four or five people. And by the way, sales teams have become larger. So it used to be that there were one or two or three people, maybe somebody from IT was sitting in and so forth. Well, today, it's not unusual to have 8 or 10 people in. Sometimes there'll be somebody from procurement, sometimes HR, often IT. Even if, let's say, you're selling something that really doesn't touch their matters, they'll still be represented. The other thing is that decisions are made on a consensus basis now. It used to be more that everybody would look to the boss would make the decision, and they'd all say, okay, that sounds good. Well, today, when you're presenting to a group, after you leave the room, they'll sit and talk and decide amongst themselves. And if they can't reach a consensus, you don't get a sale.
Okay. So you hit on, we talked about the 8 ideas not seen anywhere else. You hit on one of them. What are some of the others that we need to focus in on that are in the book?
Okay. Well, one of the ideas that I had that I actually was going to name the book this, but the publisher didn't like it. But the idea was, if you're not winning, you're losing. And what that means is, it sounds like a perfectly obvious statement, but it isn't. What it means is as a sales manager, I'd bring a salesperson into the room to go over their accounts. And I'd say, well, tell me about this account. And I'd explain it. And I go, well, are you winning? And they go, well, I think I have. Well, what does that mean? Well, they've been really nice to me. They meet with me when I want to. I haven't heard any objections in months. And I think I'm going to win this one. So I'd say, well, what signs are you seeing that you really are winning? And they sometimes sit for minutes and they go, well, I can't think of any. And so my answer was, if you're not winning and you're not getting the buying signs, then you're losing. So that means somebody else is winning, but they haven't told you that. So they're being nice. And like most people today, they don't want to have any negative confrontation. So they'll be very nice to you because they don't want to hurt your feelings. And the meanwhile, they're buying from somebody else, because the buying signals are things like, well, can you send me your contract? Can I get training? What's the next step in the process? What do you know? All these things that we would do if we knew they were going forward with us. But instead, we're getting minimal information. In fact, we get less information as the weeks go by because they start avoiding us more.
As you were talking about these signals, I even started thinking about how signals have actually changed as well.
For sure.
So this also could be a rookie mistake, where somebody says, "Hey, just send me something," or "Send me this," or "Send me that." Oftentimes, the answer should be no, because it's not the appropriate timing. So if somebody's asking for a contract and you haven't even figured out a solution together that you're trying to solve for and the problem you're trying to solve for, you shouldn't be sending that.
Correct. And the same with pricing. I really am reluctant to discuss any pricing with anybody until I know more about what they need and what value I'm going to bring to them, because I believe in value pricing. If something will save them $1 million a year versus $10,000 a year, I want more money for it if it saves them $1 million.
Most definitely. Okay, so what's another?
Another one is, and this is really radical, welcome objections. Ask for objections. If they're not giving you objections, ask them for it. Now, when I went through, I probably have gone through a dozen sales training classes, and every sales training class will have a segment on what do you do when you get an objection? And, how do you counter that objection? And what do you say when they bring up price? Or what do you say when they say they need more time? And they give you all these things that you need to do, and then you role play them until your boss believes that you really can do it. And then you go out there weaponized so that you can counter the next objection, which I call objection jujitsu. Okay. So, my suggestion is that if you're not getting objections, first of all, objections are great information. Things like your price is too high, or it's not in our budget, or the boss doesn't like your solution, or any number of things. If you're not getting objections, then you need to ask for objections. So you need to say questions like, is there any reason why you wouldn't buy from me? Is there any reason why this won't work in your environment? And take that information and don't fight with them about it. When they tell you that, well, no, we don't think it'll work here. Okay, then you can go to the next level and say, well, why do you think it won't work here? And get that information, because it's possible that the salesperson that I did a crummy job and haven't explained it well to them, and it's on me because they don't think it'll work there. I think it'll work there, but maybe they don't see that. So I need to do a better job of explaining it. Well, how do I know this if they don't tell me? So I want them to give me objections. If they don't give me any, I'm going to ask them for it.
Okay.
It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
So, I mean, people will say, I've heard this mixed message, right? So yeah. people have said, oh, you need to see objections as gifts. And other people say, well, if you actually have received an objection, more so, you need to reflect on why you even got it to begin with. It's not a gift. It's actually an indicator that you didn't execute effectively. So where do you fall on that?
Well, I think they're both valid. I mean, a lot of times, let's say if somebody says to you, your price is too high. Okay, well, what does that mean? You know, does it mean our price is higher than the competition? Does it mean that we haven't explained it well? Or maybe they're comparing apples to oranges. Someone else's price is a lot lower, but they're not including in the things that we are including. But it's very, very possible that the idea that they think your price is too high is because you as a salesperson didn't do a good enough job in explaining your value proposition. So it's on you, it's not on them. But the fact that they told you this is great information, because then you can go to the next step. Okay, let's talk about that. Why do you think the price is too high? Okay, well, you know, competitor X has a price of this. Okay, well, what is competitor X including in their price? Okay, different things like that. And a lot of that doesn't happen. People just, they run back to their boss and say, our price is too high. You know, we need to lower it.
Okay. So if you start talking about, you know, value versus price, I mean, there, as far as pricing is concerned, there's a whole lot of elements associated with it. And ultimately, if you're starting to talk about bringing value, a lot of people don't see how that differentiates and what they need to do differently in order to be able to explain it. So for example, I was in a particular conversation with somebody, and we were going through a value model, right? Okay, well, if this happens, and this is an average expectation, and this happens, you know, based on what a typical investment would be, this is the value to the business. Here's a 1-year, 2-year, 3-year projection, right? And the person just said, well, but how much does it cost? I'm like, well, I'll give you that. But the point being is that if we have no value, cost doesn't matter.
Correct. Correct. Exactly. And they won't buy. Which brings me.
Or I should be the one who says, you know what, this doesn't fit for you. I mean, the numbers don't jive.
Right. And then, so another one of my 8 items is, who is your real competitor? Well, when I did sales training, I would ask people, who is your competitor? Who's your real competitor? And they would give me a list. You know, this company, they're really tough to beat. That company, they're real tough to beat. And then I go to the next company, I'd say, who's your competitor? Well, they would tell me that. And I'd look at them and I go, they're not your competitor. These companies are not your competitor. Your competitor is do nothing. That's your competitor. Do nothing, status quo, leave it as it is. And just like you say, when you do that financial analysis, if they're disregarding that and they're not looking at at the return on investment or the positive impact of the change, the chances are pretty strong that the impetus to make a change will be such so high that they'll just stay with what they have.
Absolutely. And so ultimately the outcome of my conversation was, you know, they said, send me something. No, right. I didn't. No, I did not.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's so that your real competitor is do nothing. And right. By the way, that is your toughest competitor.
It
so
is.
If you look at the end of the year, I would sit down with the salespeople and go over, you know, their pipeline. And I'd say, well, what happened on this one? Well, they didn't make a decision. What happened on that one? Well, they didn't buy. What happened on this one? Well, I lost to competitor X. Well, their losses to competitor X were always less than the no decisions.
That's impactful right there.
Right, exactly. And a lot of times we as salespeople waste a lot of time on buyers that either we don't do a good enough job in selling them, or they just freeze when they can't make a decision. Because again, the safest thing is to do nothing. Otherwise, it's a risk. It's a risk on their part. If they make a change, it's a risk.
Well, and I think that's part of your impacting or influencing, you know, the whole status quo bias is that we're able to convey and help them to come to the realization that if I don't make a change, that that actually has greater business impact than making the change.
Right. So one of the items that I always stress when meeting with buyers is, what is the cost of doing nothing? Mm-hmm. If you don't make a change, you know, I'm here to help you in this particular area. Let's say it's inventory management, and you're having trouble getting the goods to your customers. So you're here today to talk to me because I may have a solution. Now, what happens if you don't buy from me or somebody else? Well, you know, that we're going to lose customers then. I go, okay, they're going to, because you can't fulfill their needs, right? And they go, yeah, you know, okay, well, let's look at that cost. Don't ignore that cost. It's part of your equation, okay? The cost of doing nothing really matters.
Most definitely. Okay, so what's one of your others?
Okay, what's some of the other ones? I talk about a lot in there about qualifying prospects. And again, this is something that a lot of people spend a lot of time on. And what I found, again, a lot of times was that in the do-nothing decisions, we were also dealing with unqualified prospects. So not only could they not make a decision, they didn't have any reason to buy. There was no, what I call, there's no real why on their part. So you need to know what the why is. Why would they make a change? What are their motives? What are their goals? What's in it for them? Does somebody have a personal MBO that they need to achieve by the end of the year? If they don't, you know, maybe they're not going to buy. If they don't have it in their budget, you can still sell to them, but it has to be more compelling. If they have it in their budget, that's great. If there are other competitors there, people say, well, I don't want to see other competitors there. And I go, no, that's not a bad thing. If they have other competitors there, that means it's more likely a qualified deal because they're seeing it, you're seeing it, and that means they'll buy from somebody. So buying from somebody is better than not buying at all. And your job is to make sure you're the one you're the somebody. But that's another aspect of it.
So to me, it's like part of your qualification. You know, it comes into a timing element is what it sounds like.
The timing, right. And I suggest that the best prospects are what I call, they're in the sweet spot, which are that there's a triangle that I show in there where it intersects, or three circles. And it's where their needs, your strengths, and your competitors' weaknesses all intersect. If they're in that little area there, that's your sweet spot, and that's your best prospect. That's better than the ideal customer profile because it takes into account the value proposition and the competitor, whereas the ideal customer profile does not. So that's where you, that's the best area to prospect at. Now you can make sales outside of that, but I think you need to be judicious about the time you spend on that because you could be wasting it. And time is your greatest asset in sales. As you know, if you run out of time, you can't sell anymore. So you only have so many days a year you can to reach your quota.
That's a very good point. Okay, so throw another one on us.
Well, LinkedIn. So everybody knows LinkedIn from job search. And I used it for job search. And I know people today use LinkedIn for ads. It's used for social networking, business networking. I use LinkedIn to actually find prospects and to get to the right people in the company. And I did this by, first of all, I'd have a target company. Let's say my target company was Coca-Cola. So I would start following Coca-Cola and LinkedIn. Then if I had certain titles of people that I would normally go after for the product that I was selling, let's say if it was a chief financial officer. So I put in all these titles, chief financial officer, treasurer, controller, accountant, accounting manager, and I start looking for the people in that area. And then I would try to reach out to these people and give them a reason to connect to me. So, okay, we're in the same group together. We're in the same accounting group or the same SAP group or we attended the same university or whatever. But I would always give somebody a message. Never click the button that says, please connect with me. Okay, you give them a reason why to connect with you. Once they connect with you, then you can begin to have conversations with them. Now, you don't start selling them. You start asking them questions about what they do, how they do it, what's important to them. You start sending them articles that you think might be important to them, and you start sharing information with them. By doing this, you're building up a relationship with them. And then at some point in time, you can say to them, are you the person that would be looking at this particular application? And even if they are not, that's still good because they would say, no, I don't do that. That's what Nikki does that. Okay, well, since you and I are connected, can you connect me? Can you introduce me to Nikki? Sure, I could do that. And it's a warm introduction as opposed to you reaching out to Nikki and saying, hi, I'm Steve, and I've got something I think you might want to look at. So instead I would say, well, Jim told me that, you know, that you're the person to talk to. Can we set up an appointment to talk for, say, 15 minutes a week from Tuesday? And it becomes a much easier conversation. So I was very effective with using LinkedIn. I closed the largest sale in the company's history by a multiple of 8. So whatever there was before, which was the largest one was $1.5 million, and I closed one for $12 million. So, and this was all by using LinkedIn just to reach the person, to find the person, then to reach the person, and then start working with them, feeding them information, and developing a relationship, as opposed to doing what we commonly call cold calling.
So one of the things that you start talking about, the overall volume and you know, connection requests and things like that in LinkedIn is, you know, people talk about how they are just getting bombarded with these types of requests. And because with the changes that have occurred post-COVID, we had a very short period of time where everybody went home and they didn't know what to do with themselves. And that quickly changed. Right. And it changed in a lot of very challenging ways for that, let's just say that those buyer teams. And that is now they have more responsibility than they've ever had before. They are also in a, you know, dispersed, you know, type of format, and they're all over the place. And being able to make that even simple connection is significantly more difficult than it has ever been before. So if I'm sitting there and I'm saying, hey, that's great, you know, send a connection request and stuff, but you know, now I'm getting like a point, you know, 2%, response to that. I send out 100 connections, and I may get one or two or three or less than 10 to connect. how do I move forward if I'm thinking about prospecting in today's world? Because you talk about cold calling, cold emailing, all that stuff. I mean, those performance measures are, you know, under 2%. I even saw, which was to me is like, I had to pause and for a second, a LinkedIn, one of their own experts was talking about demand and demand gen and responses and campaign responses. And they were talking about for a 10,000, connection outreach on LinkedIn, you can expect a 0.5 response. That's dismal. It actually, when you put it through the deal flow, by the time it got to sales, it said all of that in, you know, going for those 10,000, you know, potential responses, you would end up with 0.23 sales. You can't grow a business. You can't sustain a business on that.
Well, I'm not sure how that's derived, but my guess is that if you use a shotgun approach with a simple message that goes out to 10,000 people and then maybe a handful respond. And what I'm suggesting is very different. What I'm suggesting is a one-on-one personal touch campaign. And again, not with a lot of people, but with a few people going after, first of all, target companies, only the ones that you think would be possible customers for you, and then looking for the best people in terms of the title and responsibility, and then building relationship with them. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of effort on your part. It's not a shotgun approach. It's a very targeted approach. So it's not pushing a button and sending one message out to a lot of people. It's really nurturing the prospects over time and an understanding the idea of LinkedIn being one of the 6 degrees of separation, so that you can, if you can get in, like if you use the Trojan horse approach of getting into a company, once you get in and you establish a relationship with one person, then you use that person to reach out to other people, because it's greater, you have a greater probability that the next person will accept your call or your invitation if they're referred internally by somebody they trust and know.
Yeah, and I think that that's really the underlier here is how do you actually build trust in today's post-COVID world, right?
Right, and as you say, it's much harder today. And you know, with people staying at home, they're not meeting with you like they used to. It used to be a lot easier to contact somebody. If they were in your city, you'd say, can we meet and have a cup of coffee? And the chances were always really strong that they would do that. Or if you were in their city, they would meet with you and you could talk to them and build a relationship. Today, you contact them and they say, well, I've got 6 Zoom meetings today and I can fit you in from 10:20 to 10:40. And then you get on the Zoom call with them in the first 8 minutes, you're trying to figure out how to talk to each other because one or the other Zoom isn't working well. Because, I mean, this is what happens. And then when you finally speak with them, they say, well, I got to run. Goodbye. So it's really the touch factor is gone now that we used to have.
Which may be one of your, one of your 8 unique things is, you know, what I hear, I've actually been meeting in a peer roundtable and facilitating a peer roundtable with revenue generation and sales leaders for the past couple of years. And consistently they talk about, you know, finding and retaining good salespeople. You know, it's difficult to find and retain good salespeople. Hey, these salespeople that we're hiring, they don't want to work. I mean, it's just all of these things in regards to the performance of the salespeople and obtaining and finding those people. I think also too, a lot of people are saying, I'm not going into sales. That thing's too darn hard. That ain't no fun. I don't want to do that. So when you start looking at the dynamic of, you know, having people to be successful in this particular role, you know, finding and retaining those people, what are some of the things that need to change?
Well, I think today salespeople can be of greater, let's say, greater variety of personalities than it used to be. Hmm. And let's say prior times, I would say salespeople had to be extroverts and they had to be people that would enjoy being with other people and socializing with them and seeking other people. today you have a wider variety. You can, introverts can succeed today as well as extroverts, because they're, the knowledge that they have and the way they do business could be, could bring a lot of value to the prospects, to the, as opposed to in the past, where it wasn't valued as much. So in the book, I have about 20 characteristics of high performing salespeople that I put in there. And one, and I spent a lot of time trying to understand what made people succeed. And what I found was that there was really very little commonality. When I compared high performers to one another, I would say there's A, B, and C, and they had really much, not much to, and it, the same as the other in terms of personality or how they went about selling. Their styles were radically different, but they had a lot of attributes that were the same. And, you know, they had the drive, they had the business acumen, they had the emotional intelligence, they understood how to walk through a process, they were agile, they, you know, they had the financial knowledge of understanding the ROI, they could relate to the prospect, they could understand their business better. So these were the characteristics of high performers today. People think that a lot of companies, a lot of CEOs think that salespeople are only coin operated. And that's not true. I mean, you know, we salespeople love to get paid and they love to earn a lot of money. But in my case, I was more achievement oriented. I wanted to be number one. I wanted to make Presidents Club. I wanted to be the one standing up there at the podium and to have the CEO shake my hand and give me a trophy. That mattered more to me than the commission check. The commission checks were wonderful. Don't, you know, there's no mistake about that. But I was more personally rewarded by the accomplishments that I made. So I think a lot of companies undervalue that. I mean, I saw people do unnatural things in order to reach quota. So it was amazing what they would do just to, and to make President's Club. And I saw people that left the office on December 31st to call on a company on that day with the idea that they would close them the same day. And I once went to a New Year's Eve party to pick up a contract. So, I mean, just to get it in that year. It's, so salespeople have a lot of different motivations. And if companies want to keep really good salespeople, they need to understand why they're there, what they're looking for. They need to understand that they, that most of these people are very egotistical, that a lot of them like to operate on their own. They're like, they're eagles. They're not necessarily team players, and they shouldn't try to mold them into that because they won't be. It just, they're just hurting themselves and they're hurting the other people and they're driving them away. Appreciate them for what they are. They're contributors and they're high achievers. And some of them have odd personalities and some of them may be difficult to deal with, but if they bring in the numbers, you know, a lot could be forgiven.
Okay. Well then talking about, you know, finding forgiveness and, you know, we talked about collaboration, we talked about trust and all of those things. And one of the areas of struggle that we see that's very front and center and very common is the opportunity or issues associated with sales and marketing alignment. And so if you start talking about where we are today, not where we were, I mean, where we are today, what is needed in order for organizations to find success in these two operational areas?
In many companies, for sure, the ones that I work for, marketing and sales were not aligned. Their goals were totally different. So if you looked at what the marketing person, the person, let's say the VP of marketing, what they were charged with doing that year, and the VP of sales, there was no intersection. They were, marketing was supposed to do this about the brand and sales was supposed to do this about the quota. And in some companies, marketing and sales don't talk to each other. And I think that's unfortunate. Their goals need to be similar and they need to intersect. And one of the things that I also talk about is the fact that the product marketing people really don't know in many cases what the product is actually used for. And so they tell you when they do the training, you know, you need to know this, these features and functions, and this is really important, but they don't know. I would many times say, you know, I need you to come out on a sales call with me. And they would, why would I do that? Okay. Well, you know, you need to hear what these people are saying. Because I would come back and say, they're telling me they need, you know, A, B, and C. And the product marketing people would say, no, they don't need that. I go, what do you mean? Well, no, we know what they need and they need this. So again, there's some miscommunication there. And so I would make it mandatory that marketing people go out on sales calls and hear what the prospects are saying.
Well, and part of that is the whole interpretive piece, right? It's like, this is what they see as their problem, but we see something different as their problem.
And sometimes, you know, buyers can be very creative. And if they're solving a problem, and a lot of people will look at something and say, well, wait a minute, I see that you're telling me it'll do this, but I think it'll also do that. And if it does that, it solves a problem for me. And I had many of those. And I'd say, well, let's pursue that. Let's test that out. And we actually maybe do a pilot and see if it works. And then I would go back to the company and I'd say, here, this is what they want to do. And they'd look at me and they'd say, no, they don't want to do that. You know, but they did, and it worked, and it helped them. So marketing and sales need to be more in a line. And I think a lot of it has to do with marketing understanding more about what's going on in the marketplace, and not just worrying about establishing a brand and putting in a nice website. That those are wonderful things. Okay, we need those, and we need marketing literature, but we need more than that. They need to understand why companies would buy this product, what value it brings to them, and what the real world is.
Okay, so I'm sitting there. You know, I have my marketing people that are doing their thing. I have salespeople that are doing their thing. We're still not meeting our numbers. What is the first thing I need to do?
Lock them in a room and make them talk to each other. And I think that's, you know, order some pizzas and let them sit and have some pizzas and beer and talk and figure out how to get along with each other and how to help each other out. Because they're doing what they've been told to do. The marketing people don't hate sales. They have different goals and objectives. So somebody has told them, this is what you need to do this year. This is, if you're going to be a value to the company, we need a better website, or we need to have all new marketing collateral done because this is, you know, out of date, or we need to have a German version of our marketing literature, and this is your priority. Well, that's fine. Those things need to be done, but they also need to spend time with sales, and sales needs to spend time with marketing and appreciate that they won't drop what they're doing just to do something that sales needs. So Steve, they need to talk to each other.
Steve Weinberg, I've enjoyed being locked in this room with you for the past hour. I've had a good time. But how does the B2B DM gang get in touch with you?
The best place would be through my website, which would be www.steveweinberg.com. And there's a drop down where they could indicate that they want to speak with me or send an email to me, and I'll respond.
And again, Steve is the author of Above Quota Performance, Tips and Techniques to Becoming a Master Sales Pro. Steve, we'll also put a link to that on your show notes page at b2bdm.com, where you can find his show notes page just by doing a simple search for Steve. And Weinberg is Weinberg. Steve, thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom, and we wish you the very best.
You're welcome, Jim. I enjoyed our time today. Take care.
Thank you for joining us. Go now to join the B2B DM gang in the B2B Marketer LinkedIn group, where you can connect with other B2B DM disruptors and get access to our B2B DM cheat sheets, checklist, and guides. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, please help by going to iTunes to rate, review, and subscribe. And share the show on all of your digital platforms. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And always remember, you can automate your lead capture, but you must lure your lead.